I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 7th Scanon podcast of 2018. Stepping in for Niall, I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Jason.
And Ronan.
And this week we're sort of broadcasting from the front lines. We're taking a gap in the middle of our Dublin Film Festival experiences to discuss what we watched in the week in film, coming up to the Oscars in the middle of the Audi Dublin International Film Festival with a host of other stuff going on. So we're just going to jump right on in there and ask, Jay, what have you watched this week?
I'm a world-weary veteran of film at this stage. It's been an exhausting week. But we've got plenty... I'll mention something that wasn't a festival thing, that was a kind of Sunday morning kind of decompress, I guess. And that was The Savages.
Oh, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Tamara
right.
Jenkins film. I haven't seen it. I have a precious handful of Philip Seymour Hoffman films I haven't seen. And I'm eking them out to myself probably 6 months at a time. Because that's all I got. Like,
pretend they're still coming.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, because like the new films, if I say they are, right?
Yeah.
So like, I think one's only getting here.
It just happens to be a period piece set in 2003.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're near nostalgia now. I'm fine with that.
He's looking very well these days.
He is. But it's a wonderful film. I liked Tamara Jenkins. I watched Slums of Beverly Hills earlier on this year, which I hadn't seen before either, and it's incredible. So, like, tough. And she's a new film that actually I think was in Sundance, which I'm very, very much looking forward to seeing. But Savage is great. Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman, the siblings.
Yeah.
Who kind of look after their ailing parent. Mm-hmm. They're kind of estranged from the dad, like. And there's kind of other historical family stuff that's kind of hinted at, but not necessarily kind of explicit. And it's funny, it's sad, it's knowing.
Yeah.
Hoffman has this great speech about death in it, which is kind of makes it even more poignant in that kind of sense as these things go.
Yeah.
But really, really lovely.
They're a really good pairing. So I think both of those are actors who have this great ability to get really tough with each other and really tear into each other in ways that's incredibly painful to watch. You know, you recognize that maybe from your own life.
And yet very empathetic.
And yet they can come back to you afterwards. Yeah. And there's a clear, real relationship there and they sell it.
But
so
they feel
well.
Lived in.
Linney
and Hoffman as performers, typically when they take a role, even if it's like, I remember watching Mission Impossible 3 at Christmas and being like, Philip Seymour Hoffman is so good.
Yeah. He actually raises that film star.
Oh, he does.
Easily.
Yeah.
Like, he's that good in it. Like, he actually gives a threat that bad guys in films almost never have.
No, no,
like,
but
he actually feels like he could kill Tom Cruise, which is a rare thing. Like,
gravity can't kill Tom Cruise.
But he actually feels like he could kill Tom Cruise here.
Yeah.
Well, that's a rare feeling.
He gives that kind of stock speech, which is, you got a family, you got someone to love you, you know, hunt them down and kill you, which is stock villain 101. But, like,
he gives so much to it.
He's
probably the loss of my lifetime of an actor that, like, I've never like wished there was more of him for any actor of my whole life. Like he's an incredible actor. But I think I have a couple more. I can't remember the titles still to watch that I haven't seen. Watch me in 6 months.
I was gonna say, would you not just
glut? No, 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 no. There's no glutting here. I'm savoring.
Because it is such a wonderful discovery to have a new performance by somebody like that. I remember like in the wake of his death. I watched three films I had already seen because I wasn't able to take in something new.
Yeah, yeah, I totally understand that. It's almost morning period.
That's the comfort, it's the comfort of the familiar.
But it's really good. I mean, as I said, as a director, I think she's terrific. And she's very empathetic and loves her characters and crucially knows her characters and what they're like, good and bad, which I really like in a director. I find that you'd think it'd be obviously some director's skill, but it's not always the case that really knows the characters that well. You know, she writes her own stuff, obviously, as well. So she really informs the film with her kind of worldview and stuff. It's really good.
Right, and I think Ronan, as our sort of podcast Eastwood aficionado or completionist, I think you mentioned you'd seen...
Yeah, I variously call him Eastwood completist and
somebody
apologist.
Has to be.
Somebody has to
Hey,
be.
Hey.
Ronan is the chair.
No, I have been a very big Eastwood fan for a very long time. And have defended him through some tough patches, including the whole chair thing, which, you know, let's not.
No.
But, I went along to the 1517 to Paris because it was the last day it was showing and I didn't like the idea
it's
of not having
gone.
Seen... It's gone now, yeah. It lasted a week.
I didn't really see the attraction here for it, really.
Yeah,
like, there's no actor.
It didn't crack the top 10. Yeah.
It went for 1 week on the very cusp. It was like number 9 or number 10 a few weeks ago.
There was there's just a lot showing at the moment.
Yeah.
I don't think
it's not a great time for it.
That's my issue, is that I would love to see it, and I will see it. I'll see it on home video, but I just couldn't justify going to see it.
Probably won't. But anyway,
that does not surprise me, Jay.
You sit negatively on Eastwood these days.
Yeah, it's taken a long time. I was a big huge Eastwood fan when I was younger, like as director and actor.
Well, I think in as much as I am an Eastwood, and I don't necessarily like the term apologist, I think he's still doing incredibly interesting work. He is certainly in a place now where his work is far less
technically accomplished.
Yeah, of course, everyone goes
through phases. I mean, he was at the time at whatever, 89 or whatever,
to be doing a movie or two a year. Yeah, a movie or two a year.
Makes Woody Allen look like a slouch.
That's it. And like his, and like whatever Ronan said about like him not being as technically accomplished as he once was, his direction is still far more ambitious than Allen's, just in terms of technique, I would argue. I think so.
Alan's kind of reverted to the point where he's gotten back to being more of a writer than a director now. And he did have a period, I think, certainly in kind of the 80s and the 90s, where he experimented with direction a lot. Clint has always, well, Clint obviously has never been a writer. He's always been a producer-director and very, very good at it. Because I think that's the key thing, and that's where 1517 to Paris becomes interesting, is that as a producer-director, I think he's been producing his own films since 82, Firefox.
What a note to
Firefox
start on.
Firefox is not a good one. There are very few Clint Eastwood films I hate, but all the ones I hate are the purely action films. Firefox, Tiger Sanction, The Rookie with Charlie Sheen.
Which
is the film he made, I can't remember which side of Unforgiven, but it was like directly
the
next
bad side
for whichever,
regardless of
it's astonishing that he did that. And then did, or you know, directly before did. I think
you're
saying
as if like Hereafter and whatever didn't follow like the hottest, one of the hottest
films
of his career.
Yeah, sure, of course. But 1517 Paris, anyway, it's I can understand a lot of the criticisms. A lot of people have said that it's no good, and there are points where I sort of put my head in my hands, like, what are you doing, Clint? But it's very interesting the way he has been interesting for a number of years now in reevaluating his own image, ideals of American masculinity.
He's always been obsessed with that.
And violence,
The role he has played in fostering that culture. A lot of people have called out the fact that Letters from Iwo Jima turns up in a poster in the background, and it's in the context of this sort of bedroom scene where an American kid is playing with a load of toy guns. And there's this idea that he's keenly aware that his own films have contributed to this mythos of masculinity being forged,
particularly American
violence, warfare,
American,
and all the rest. And I found it really interesting that it was Letters from Iwo Jima rather than Flags of Our Fathers. I mean,
it's
both
better film.
That's very true.
I think it is.
They're both very elegiac, but you know, it's interesting the way he's playing with it. And similarly, he had a clip from Rawhide turn up in Jersey Boys, which
I remember that.
One of the great
cameos.
Very, very funny.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
You know, contributing to, again, to his own sense of the way that he has created this idea of masculinity that he's been tearing down for essentially 50 years now. You go back to Play Misty for Me in 71, he's interrogating his own sex symbol status.
He's never been one to hide behind his masculinity in that way. Like, and he could easily have been
given that a lot of people's read on Eastwood is that he embodies rather than deconstructs or analyzes that. Like, I mean, that's one of my...
I mean, the American right certainly thinks that.
Eastwood has the
flag waving behind them.
There's a whole host or a certain segment of like American popular culture that seems to latch on the idea that Eastwood is the characters he played. So I can completely understand why so many of his films are engaged with him having a discussion with that. I mean, I watched Gran Torino recently, and Gran Torino, I like it. It's a flawed film, but I like it a lot.
I've never seen Gran Torino. I've seen the Get Off My Lawn memes. That was pretty much all I've seen of it.
That's the interesting thing. That's kind of an example of the way that Eastwood takes off, and people sort of forget that there is something going on behind it. It's not just this, you know,
get off my lawn.
No name 50 years on.
Get Off My Lawn is what the public thinks Eastwood is, and Gran Torino is what Eastwood is conversing with that. Like that. Without getting too spoilery, there's the whole discussion about the use of force and guns and weapons in Gran Torino. I mean,
you can spoil that to some degree. I mean, it's been out a few years. I'll catch it, but you know, as long as you don't tell me the explicit ending of it.
I'll tell you the explicit ending. Clint Eastwood sings the closing song in Gran Torino.
So tenderly. It's an incredible
performance.
It's very strange.
But it's so strange, but it's, again, Eastwood deconstructing his own masculinity.
It's exactly,
it's like you can imagine the red-blooded American males who are like, girl, we're going to see a manly Clint Eastwood film. And it's like,
sensitive singing. Yeah, but you know what worries me though? You all say that, and yeah, and I think you're both correct, and I think we're kind of full agreement on it. I think the public that goes to see that comes out of Gran Torino or comes out of the new one or comes out and still thinks
American
that
Sniper
because they don't engage
yes.
in the material
yeah.
that way.
Yes,
but that's not the director's fault.
No, it's not. I'm
yes,
not suggesting
yes,
for
no,
a second.
No, I agree. And
I think that's the problem with America more than Eastwood.
Yeah, this was a huge problem I had with American Sniper, which I think is, you know, by no means a great film. And
no,
has
it's
a
not.
Many problems.
But it's not a
but
right
it's
way propaganda film.
Exactly, which is how it was taken by a lot of people, including sort of intelligent liberal people who came to that film and chose not to see the new
one. But I think at the point, though, I will say, at the point when that was kind of released, in America was kind of probably fracturing apart, so
yes.
Thomas and either
right.
or
absolutely.
Kind of thing. And
absolutely.
I don't, and maybe that wasn't the time to be engaging in a kind of
well, I mean,
teasing it out,
a nuanced take on
which they should have, but they should have, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I mean, it should have been
like the ultimate litmus test on American Sniper is basically there was always going to be a Chris Kyle movie. Is this the best possible Chris Kyle movie that you could have?
I think it is.
And I'm like, yes.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah.
No,
as
right.
flawed as it is.
Because
so.
Whoever, like,
Robert
if that's a Peter Berg film or whatever.
Yeah, David O. Russell.
With star Mark Wahlberg, it's a very different film.
Yeah.
Like, and it could.
Yeah.
And if Eastwood hadn't snapped up the right, goddamn right, they would have made it. And they would have made it in the way that they make it.
Yeah.
Like Lone Survivor
Fiver,
or whatever your kind of film you're talking about. And that's why exactly you're absolutely right. It is the best film. It's the best you could have got. You could have got out of it.
And it's kind of the same with the new film that. It's again looking at these ideas. There's a whole like it ends with a really celebratory actual footage of these guys who foiled a terrorist plot on a train to Paris, being presented with Légion d'honneur by François Hollande, and it's very celebratory and woo go these guys, they saved the day. But throughout, it's kind of peppered with this whole thing of. You know, these ideas of American exceptionalism and do you know, is that narrative forged on something real or do we look at things afterwards and go, oh, that happened because of
and then place it on.
Yeah.
It, you know, it really interrogates that and it doesn't necessarily do so with a great deal of filmmaking skill at times. There is one moment that is shot terribly. I could not believe how badly it was. It's just a moment and this is where the apologist kicks in. I sort of looked at him and went, is this him doing an ironic bit? No, it's just...
See, that's the problem, isn't it? You couldn't excuse that. It's like, oh,
yeah,
no,
yeah.
maybe he's trying to do
no,
a thing.
I will put my hand up and say that first, you know, sequence of shots, that first scene that comes after the title card is despicably badly shot.
Okay.
It is absolutely...
I like that, right after the title card.
Right
like,
after the title card.
Get your rating there.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And, you know, Eastwood cinematographer Thomas Stern is really good, generally. And this actually, worth noting, just from like an aesthetic perspective, is a lot brighter than a lot of his films have been. He's got that criticism a lot. People say that you know his films are visually very dark. And he's kind of come out of that for the last couple of movies. It's nice to see for a change. There's a bit of sunlight.
What
there.
About the non-actors?
Yes, the three non-actors, which is that's great 90s pop band.
Yeah, I think it's really, really fascinating. And it brings something really strange to the film where they're talking about, you know, there's a lot of people have criticized the dialogue in the film. Where they say things like, you know, I feel like the universe is propelling me towards something.
Oh, jeez, okay.
Yeah,
I can understand that, though.
And Jay has just checked out of watching me.
No,
I think in terms of the script and what it's trying to do, it's, you know, again, interrogating those ideas of American exceptionalism. Americans always think that they have a higher purpose.
Yeah,
that's a very broad generalization.
No, but I know what you're getting at.
Yeah, you know, the film is kind of looking at this idea that this is the way they, and especially in the context of a European road movie, which is largely what it is for a big portion of it.
It's like your ship, except with guns.
Yeah.
There's your pull quote for the poster.
You got that one for free. Whoever released it.
I think what's interesting is that these actors believe in what they're saying because this is their story and this is, you know, they're telling it in a slightly different way to Eastwood and they believe it. They're clearly non-professionals and there are moments where you kind of roll your eyes and think, oh no.
I think
but it adds a layer of something... I don't think it's quite fully formed, and as I say, I think it's more interesting conceptually than artistically. Maybe.
I probably would have made a bit more money if there was actors in it.
I
would have thought.
Yes.
Also, I just want to say before we get out of this because I really like this, and I think you might be wrong. I'd say, does somebody made a point on Twitter that you should end the movie with a real life picture of the actors they were going to cast instead as if they're going to mirror biography
have the sort of fading picture of the guys from the
Wahlberg,
movie
Wahlberg Affleck and
Matt Damon Bradley Cooper again
preferably holding an Oscar completely inappropriate
which I thought was a wonderful image I'd say that would be brilliant. Sorry, I had to get there in case we gone past
but I think you're right that they you know they could have easily cast three you know mid to to high kind of high standing actors. And Warner, they throw money at Eastwood.
I'm amazed. Well, maybe, obviously, he insisted upon this.
I think, yeah.
Well, I mean, like,
he could have got good actors for that. He could have got good actors. Actors.
Yes. Yeah. The fact that they financed it even after he said he wasn't. I mean, like, yeah.
Well, in fairness, they financed it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Warner's
did that with Kubrick as well. Just do what you want. They do, in fairness, Foster.
And they do it with Nolan as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I mean, Warner's
this point has been... Since 1976, he has directed all but one of his films for Warner. They have a very nice
arrangement. Yeah,
they have a very nice arrangement. It's worked very well for them.
What I really like about Warner's, and just I'm not going to get bogged down the whole thing, but Warner's had a kind of thing, a new deal with Filmstruck yesterday, where they added a lot of their archive to the historical archive,
which is not available in Ireland yet.
It is, but it isn't. They'll take your money, but they won't give any films.
Well.
Talk about him off
podcast.
We'll
talk about that. But what's really interesting about it, and how you develop kind of relationship with filmmakers, and it also applies to the Netflix kind of scenario as well.
Which we'll probably be talking about in a moment.
Yeah, but exactly that. Well, there's rights
and nice segue
but
there.
In terms of Warner's, I always thought like fostering kind of, particularly with people that have long careers in your Allens or your Eastwoods, like what an archive. But like eventually Woody Allen's going to die, he's going to die. And you've got 50 years of that stuff is worth something somewhere and everywhere.
Yeah.
A prestige, and all the things that they get.
Beautiful Eastwood
box set.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually waiting for the Blu-ray edition because the DVD box set is something like something absurd.
The Blu-ray edition would be incredible.
I have a 35 film Clint Eastwood box set.
Yeah,
35 films, and they're missing a few because I don't know, they couldn't fit it in the box or something.
But I do like that with a studio that thinks. 30 or 40 years down the line of what, like, and literally the Warner Archive, what it's worth.
I don't even think they're thinking that far. I think they're thinking 5 or 10 years. Eastwood produces another American Sniper, even Gran Torino.
Yeah,
like, but
Alone Forgiven is like the kind of benchmark of like maybe.
No, but I mean financially. Eastwood as a director, the amount of like the money that he's earned. Who like breaks their box office records in their 80s?
Yeah, I know.
And not to mention, to this day, he's incredibly efficient. You know, it is always on time, under budget.
Also, same
thing with Nolan.
Also, point out Woody Allen brought in Midnight in Paris. After, I don't know how much that made, but it made an absolute fortune.
Blue Jasmine as well.
And there's well. Yeah. So
I won't mention Cassandra. But it can happen. Is what I'm saying.
And
that's where you foster relationships.
It demonstrates the appeal of those.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting thing. And moving on to Netflix, and you can take that exactly what I'm coming at.
Nice segue there.
Yeah.
I watched Mute. I watched it last week. I couldn't talk about it last week because I signed an embargo saying I couldn't actually talk about having seen it. So you can guess how good the movie was.
Well, we think the internet has told us.
The internet has mentioned
it. Has spoken.
Has reached a verdict on it. I didn't hate it. It's not a good film. You should not watch it if you're on the fence. If you are in any way curious, I think it's an interesting...
I'd probably watch it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating film in terms of Netflix just giving a filmmaker money to do whatever the hell they want. And like the thing about watching Mute is it feels like... And this is the closest read that I have on it, is it's basically a Harrison Ford super fan sort of combination of Witness and Blade Runner with a subplot that is somebody doing a Quentin Tarantino impression
doing
a Woody Allen impression, adapting David Bowie's Time in Berlin.
You cram
them all into a movie, make it 2 hours and 6 minutes long, and just watch. And it's...
Two words. That fills the heart of every film fan with dread.
2 hours.
Passion Project.
It does,
It, like, I mean, and every great director, Scorsese's fallen into it.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Great directors, and arguably Gangster York, although there's lots more in Gangster York than there is in Silence, I think. But it happens with filmmakers that long gestating projects that they needed to make when they were 35 because the thing in them, when you're 60, it's...
As opposed to having it fester or whatever.
The
famous story with Mute is that he originally wrote it as a Britpop thriller in the style of Guy Ritchie, and then was like, I'll move it to future Berlin.
You should have just given him $25 million to make that.
Add a subplot and add this sort of other stuff. But it's absolutely... Like, and again, like you mentioned the passion projects, and yes, they're not great, and they're generally not the best work that a director will ever do, but they're always generally interesting.
I agree with that.
In terms of, you know, maybe not rewarding and maybe not like the classic, nobody's going to be talking about like Mute as Duncan Jones' misunderstood masterpiece.
Yeah.
But
the only thing I'd say about that is Duncan Jones hasn't done enough work yet to be digging out long treasure trove. Like, he's been around for like 10 years.
He hasn't had
20 years of bitter experience before he pulled that passion project out of the drawer. Okay. And he hasn't had like $150 million or $500 million
hits to justify
it.
I mean, yeah.
Now Netflix is like, if they're offering the money, I can understand it. Don't get me wrong.
And from their point of view, it's no loss.
No,
and I mean, myself and Jay were talking about this when Jay was wondering, like, why wouldn't you take the $150 million and give it to 10 different small indie directors to go and make their own personal projects? And the answer to that is, like, every film festival ever will have dregs of those movies. And I mean, not talking in terms of quality. I'm not talking in terms of quality, but like films like Beast, for example, which, you know, won't get a huge theatrical release or whatever, but will, you know, end up on Netflix in perpetuity.
Even Mudbound, you can spend $15 million on a Sundance.
That sort of stuff. Yeah. But I mean, the issue is that you then have these big science fiction films that you can lure people in, and people apparently love Bright.
Well, Bright 2 was being greenlit in a heartbeat.
Yeah. But
without a certain person's involvement, thankfully. Netflix, and this is the only worry I have for Netflix, they don't really care about the quality of anything because it doesn't really matter to them.
You say that, though,
I do.
Right? But Netflix, thank you, Jay, for affirming what I just said.
Yes.
I like the passion.
Thank you.
But no, like you say that, but Netflix have, like, for every, you know, the Cloverfield Paradox or every, you know, this movie that we're talking about right now, they've also produced stuff like Beasts of No Nation, which I think is a fantastic film that absolutely 110% deserves to be seen. They produced Mudbound.
They snatched up Mudbound.
They're internationally distributing films like Annihilation.
They picked up Annihilation in the same way that they picked up the Cloverfield Paradox. And they picked up another one I heard as well. I can't remember the name. I've read an article today. And that's why when I say they don't care, I guess what I mean in terms of quality, they don't care that critics don't like it. They care about how their algorithms measure what people on their service
are watching. And
what they watch from the film they watch and so on and so forth.
Yeah. But there's a lot of what, you know, getting to a position where they can say, if you like this more, you know, it's about keeping people engaged. Yeah.
Well, that's it exactly. And I mean, we had Nicola on the podcast last week who was talking about, like, the thing about she didn't love the Cloverfield Paradox, but from a person's point of view watching the film is, right, you can watch it on Netflix for the €8 a month that also gets you Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Probably €10 a month now,
you know, a Star Trek Discovery and everything else that you ever wanted. Mm-hmm. And you get to watch it on a new film on Friday night for free, even if it's terrible.
But this
is what Netflix are
very good at, though. Yeah. We know that people are going home on the weekend, and they don't have to traipse to the bloody Omniplex and spend £40 on a family.
Yeah, they can bring their own food that they've bought.
They can sit on the couch watching it.
Yeah. And home studio systems are now...
The film studios still haven't figured out that this...
is the future.
Is it? Well, even if it's not necessarily the future, and there's always a future of cinema, they still haven't understood that people want to see things when they see things. Like, it's not always...
Yeah, instant. Well, I mean, we're probably going to talk about this when we talk about the Oscars, in terms of, like, market penetration, having everything accessible. But before we do that...
Yes.
We're recording this podcast in the middle of the Dublin Film Festival.
Yes, we are.
We're precisely at the midpoint today on Tuesday.
Yeah.
We have all been attending various films and screenings over the past week or so. Jay sort of joined us as late on Saturday. So let's sort of talk about what we've seen at the festival, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Okay.
So do anybody want to jump in there best and worst?
I'd like to jump in. I died of four films Saturday, which I'll kind of talk about briefly, which was pretty
my
good,
day
actually.
With Jay.
Yeah,
I had a five film Saturday with an 80% overlap with Jay.
I did not have a five film Saturday, but
you won.
We started with Dawson City Frozen Time, which was the documentary.
All three of us were it.
Yeah,
it's really, really good.
It's terrific.
Really fascinating thing about kind of archive and the role of archive and what you see, how it's edited to show what you see.
Well, not even that, the social history.
Yeah.
It's a social history of America.
You know, Fred Trump turns up and kind of weird little asides like Fatty Arbuckle and the connection, all the overlapping
stories and elements.
And how films end up, like where films go, the physical film, where they end up 2 years later in somewhere north of Canada, and it's like, no, they don't want them back. The films are gone.
It's too expensive to ship them back.
And it's all about, and it really gets at something profound about how Hollywood thought of their product in the sense of the value of it.
Yeah.
Like the physical value of something that exists.
I'd go even further, and I'd say the wonderful thing about Dawson City Frozen Time is it's a story of American capitalism
that just
tells it through film.
It happens, the same greed, the same...
Yeah, it happens repeatedly in the film where you have this story about like greed and and expense and stuff for. So, like, the reason that all the film is on nitrate film, which explodes, is because it's cheaper. Yeah. The reason that you have this giant repository of leftover silent films buried in Canada is because the studios were too cheap to actually bring it back and destroy it properly.
And the reason why it's kept there is because there was a bloody gold rush and everybody rushed there. So the only reason there was money there in the first place is because
they kind of had to chase for money.
And then the company that takes over the gold thing consolidates the whole thing in the great American way that they do.
There's a really great line in there where, you know, once the gold was exhausted, the patrons began mining the miners. But it's a beautiful film, and it lovingly constructs this narrative. I did think it was a little bit unfocused in place. I could have done, maybe this is because I'm Irish, with a bit less baseball.
I would agree with you there, but I think it's the way the story is told, like you say, it constructs a narrative. It does, but it's kind of, it almost feels incidental. You know,
it's almost strolling around the place.
Exactly. Something comes along and you go, oh, that ties back into that. And like you say, the whole thing, it is, I think, that the great strength of it is that it's a story of American capitalism and, you know, the way social history is tied up with cinema, especially capitalism, the political system. And again, even the fact that these films were, you know, quite amazingly buried in this place was because this one guy was in charge of this thing and this thing
at
and
the
this
same time,
thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, a conglomerate saved us in the end. It really gets to how I think it's all
how incidental things are as well. Like, they accidentally discover.
There's a lot of incredible coincidences.
It's very well told. Like all the little details that it sets off. Some of them don't come boomeranging back around, but the ones that at the end really do, which is very, very effective.
But I talked about it, I think yourself that I think Ronan as well later on that kind of that moving idea of people standing outside of.
Somebody's staring at the camera.
I find that incredibly moving. I always have. And that kind of historical thing. And you know, they're all dead. And you see those kind of great kind of panoramic photos of outside a new hotel.
The film starts with this whole mention. And it goes back to the very beginning of cinema. You know, we start with the Lumiere brothers. But it mentions this incredible morning where somebody filmed workers in the morning and showed them in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And they're incredible. And you get this footage of people knowing that this is going to happen and looking at themselves. And sort of because this is a brand new technology, understanding the transience of it. And it takes on this sort of strange spectral spiritual quality where these are people who realize that their, you know, their image is being captured for eternity and that they're looking
at it. I find that very moving.
I find it very odd. The score of the film really hammers that home.
I think it's really beautiful.
I had heard a lot of great things about this film before seeing it, but I hadn't heard that it has as good a score.
Me too.
I closed my eyes a few times. Yeah, just let it wash over me. I really could have watched it for a long, long time more.
I know you were saying about the baseball thing, and it is kind of. It's maybe an aside to some degree.
It's a good aside. It's just not an aside, I think, that particularly belongs in this
story.
But
I suspect there's like four or five other stories they left out that I really want to see. And I want to like buy on Blu-ray. There's another
extended edition.
And stuff like that.
It's
like, I know, eagerly
Ken
watch
Turnses,
every exactly. All over it. Like,
there's a whole Reeling in the Year series to be made
Yes. But I won't go into all the stuff I watch. And I'm going to skip Squeak Country because I don't really want to talk about films. I thought it was terrible.
Yeah,
but we'll let you do that.
No. We'll be talking about that when it comes out in a few weeks. It actually has an Irish release. It's advertising the iFi.
Oh, okay.
Five stars. I understand.
Yeah, from Little White Lies, The Guardian.
But Almora actually mentioned the two I saw yesterday.
Jay gave one of those 5 stars, I think.
One of them. one of those 5 stars. Marlena, the Murderer in 4 Acts.
Oh, we saw that as well. I had another day with Jay last night.
This is an Indonesian film. By a female director whose name escapes me, which I'll look up in a second. But this was a kind of... it's not a thriller, because that's not right. It's a meditative drama that certainly
has a... It's
a
dramatic western in some way, I would argue.
Yeah, yeah.
That
it does have elements of the thriller in it, the tension in it a little bit.
It has a little bit of tension, but like... And this, you're going to hate me for saying this. It felt almost Tarantino-esque in places, but without the violence. In terms of its way,
I'd go back to kind of establishing Whitechapel as the only with you coming over on the horse on the thing.
But I mean, even in terms of writing, where he takes what would be a short scene in any other film, or she takes what would be a short scene in any other film, and extends it out to the first 20 minutes, so you get a sense of it being lived in. Yeah. It sort of reminds me of the way that Tarantino, when he was younger, and to a certain extent still does, where he builds roomy...
Like that opening scene in Inglourious Basterds is a nice example.
Yeah. Or, the fact that, the scenes that you think about when you think about Inglourious Basterds, like the one where they order beer with three fingers, which doesn't need to be there plot-wise, or could be a lot leaner and more efficient, but is feels roomy for that. So there's a lot of that in there. Like, it is four acts. And each of those four acts, for me, felt almost like one of those extended scenes.
Yeah, it did. Like, it clearly connects. Like, there's a story that kind of passed through, and there's revenge in it. There's kind of female autonomy. Yeah.
There's a lot
beheadings.
Of emotion in there. There's sincerity, warmth,
there's friendship, and there's
compassion and empathy,
and kind of how strangers come to your aid if you're really stuck and vice versa.
And sometimes don't.
But there is community in it, in a way that... And the lead character eventually really gets agency in the sense of owns the story. It's the director's name is Muli Surya.
Is this her debut?
It's her second or third film. But really, really good.
It really is. I would wholeheartedly recommend.
I was surprised how good it was for some reason. Because, as I said to you before, I'm not a big fan of the first act, second act, third act, fourth act thing. Because if act one is terrible, you're like, oh, jeez, three more acts to go. So, once you start numbering them, it's it really kind of sets out time. But it works, and it's fine.
It does.
I didn't remember, we watched last night, was You Were Never Really Here, the Lynn Ramsey.
Yes.
Excruciating... Q&A aside,
I'm just saying the film was slightly
pretty
shorter.
It was
45 minutes. It was half the length of the film. It was more than half the length.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. You don't mind Q&As if they're with a director who's told him it's something that interests them or excites them. With an interviewer who knows what they're doing. The issue is when you open it up to the floor and you have the guy who's like, I want to talk about the work of F.W. Murnau. Or, why did you change the ending of the book that I liked so much? You don't understand this story that you're making. Always
middle-aged
men.
Of that. Awful,
always middle-aged
awful.
Men.
But the film is pretty terrific.
Really like the film. Not as good as We Need to Talk About Kevin, I would argue.
Well, not a first watch, but I would argue that it will need time to settle. I'll probably rewatch it in a couple of years.
Probably going to provoke you a little bit, but it reminded me a lot of mid-tier Fincher. You know when Fincher goes through his phase and he does something that's would otherwise be a very standard genre conventional piece, but he elevates that.
Like,
so, like, for example, the Game or Panic Room or something like that. I feel like Never Really Here has the look of a movie that could be Death Wish, isn't.
It reminded me of Good Time, the Safdie Brothers film.
No, it's much better than Good Time.
And I didn't say it was. I didn't say Good Time is better than. I'm saying as a double bill, I could see why you'd watch them together.
If we're saying it's better than Good Time, it must be very good.
Good Time is
good
great.
Good Time is fantastic.
Thank you.
Good Time.
I've been saying this.
Good Time.
So did I.
Good Time is grand.
I absolutely loved Good Time.
Good Time.
I want to pull up my Good Time review.
Just
four
sort of
and a half
read
stars,
it.
Which is very generous of me.
Really?
It's glorious. Absolutely glorious. I felt I was in the palms of people that had absolute mastery of what they're telling. Which I'm rarely in that space, they know exactly the story.
And it has this peculiar sense of spontaneity that yet is very controlled.
And it has it's not freewheeling, because that's the wrong word, but it has this kind of track where they know exactly it's here, but between the lines, it can go off in all sorts of little ways. It reminded me of? The Scorsese film,
At First.
Isn't it the
greatest compliment I can pay? Is that's the only thing I can think to compare
it
to. That
isn't
it's so like that.
Like
that
you know, Scorsese exactly where the start point is, the end is,
and it comes back.
God,
and you
between
go,
there, wiggles all over the place, zigzags everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Good Time is. You're never really here. It doesn't have that in the sense of the narrative structure of it. But my God, it has this ferocious violence, essentially off screen, kind of.
Which is remarkable.
It's a violent film without being violent at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is probably Lynn Ramsey trademark to some degree. Like,
yeah,
it's
you
interesting because the marketing materials do make it seem as if it's going to be very on screen violent.
You look at a lot of hammers.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily see anything.
But there's a lot of before and after, and there's a lot of like really good truncated kind of snapshots in suggesting violence.
Yeah.
There's like wonderful technique in terms of how it's structured. There's a sequence without getting too spoilery in which like what would in any other movie be like the centerpiece. You know, I think I was sitting beside Niall and he said, okay, here comes the raid moment. But
I suggested Old Boy a little bit as well.
But the way that Ramsey chooses to execute that scene, no pun intended, is in terms of framing it through a rotating CCTV camera. So you edit around.
You're right over the camera. And
yeah. You edit around
the scene almost, you know. And yeah. You see the
so you get like the moment of set. So you see what happens at the start. You cut to a corridor. You cut back, and it's over and done with. And it happens repeatedly throughout
really
the film.
Bloody
it's
beautiful.
Yeah,
like it has this kind of. Almost like kind of floating quality,
ethereal sort
yeah,
of, yeah, on intangible.
And you know, Ramsay knows exactly what she's doing.
Yeah.
She's read this novella. And she's like, yeah, I've got this. I know exactly how to put this. And it does something at the end. Now, I've never read the book, so I don't know the ending. But I'm not that guy on cinema. But it does something at the end that I really, really bloody loved. I'm not going to say it because
it carries on. I think what we've talked about already in some ways.
And
feels
it does a couple of things at the end. One, a very particular kind of plot point thing, which I really loved, and then follows off from that with something really, really nice and really interesting that it does. And I remember going, you know, when sometimes if you watch a film, and you're like, please don't mess up the ending.
Yeah,
where, you know, those last 5 minutes,
you can see it potentially going
wrong. And it's like I didn't have that worry at all because
you were in safe hands.
Because you knew you were in safe hands, and that's why it's a perfect kind of companion piece to go time. I think is there's two films that the directors know exactly what they're doing, have this lovely scuzzy aesthetic, and obviously, sorry, I'm not going to go back to Good Time again, but how good is Robert Pattinson in that movie? Oh, holy shit, man. Anyway, sorry. But that's the last we say Good Time, Darren. Stop looking at me like that. Anyway.
It's an audio medium, Jay.
Yeah. You Were Never Really Here opens here in 2 weeks, I think.
Yeah,
March
11th.
9th. March 9th.
You say 9th, I say 11th. Tatum's hat. Let's call
the
whole thing off.
Settle on March 10th. Saturday, March
10th. Actually, March 11th is Sunday, isn't it?
Yes. That would
it's opening on Sunday, folks. Gets in the cinemas on Sunday.
Interesting
really
innovative.
Strategy.
Yeah.
Like, this could work.
But to be fair, it would give it like a 6-day weekend.
Indeed.
It's
pretty great. You should go see
it. It really is. You should go see it. I absolutely loved it. Ronan, you've also been festivaling it.
I have indeed. And as per usual, the majority of the things I've seen that I've loved are older films or possibly ones I've seen before. You know, the retrospectives. They
I
had,
love those.
I think due to an issue with another film and getting the DCP of it to work, they showed Andrzej Wajda's Canal, which I hadn't seen before. It's absolutely tremendous. Really blew me away.
I've never seen it.
It's set during World War II, during the sort of Polish retreat, I think 1944. The Nazis are closing in. There's a group of Polish soldiers sort of running away, essentially. And for a while, they're encamped on a battlefield. They're living in a sort of rundown house. There's quite a bit of sex going on. It's a real existential thing. Beautifully shot. Real kind of, you know, the black and white monochrome really brings to light the themes of sort of terror and this. Reminded me a lot of the kind of films Rossellini did right after the war.
Rome Open City.
Germany Year Zero, which is still one of my favourite films. It's just
almost rewatched it. Because I watched this Scorsese documentary on Italian film, you know, the 4 hour, four and a half hour thing.
Voyage
and
to Italy.
Yeah, it's awesome, fantastic. But it has a lot in that as well. Watch it, really need to rewatch that.
Yeah,
and then get to a few minutes later, Umberto D, or really need to rewatch it.
Yeah,
also,
it's about 4 hours long.
Umberto D is my favourite.
Umberto D,
it's
better than Bicycle Thieves.
It's better than Bicycle Thieves.
It's
interesting. Umberto D is incredible.
Heartbreaking, and not just because there's a key tears
after it.
That movie makes me cry so much.
Oh, good lord, it's amazing. It's so good. Anyway, go on.
But
aside,
Canal then, and it's you know, I was really into it for this first, I think, half hour, and then it does something really interesting. It takes a sort of selection of its quite large ensemble cast and puts them in a sewer as they're trying to escape the city, and it becomes this bizarre Dante-esque descent through literal rivers of shit as they're fleeing.
So there's your warm
there's your canal,
and it's just phenomenal, the camera work. There's this incredible thing that that they do where they'll keep like pulling in from a long shot, closing in on an extreme close-up of the face, and it's a beautiful new restoration, actually, the Polish Film Institute have done. It was really incredible. I was really blown away by it. I think it was the first film I saw, and you know, this is often the case that, you know, you'll go along to a couple of older films, and naturally, you know,
you saw a performance as well, I think.
Yeah, exactly. If it's an older film, it's, you know, especially something that's as old as that, it's in the festival to a certain extent because it's a classic.
Yeah.
So it's not fair to stack.
Yeah, it's
but
not
going to
be. Yeah,
of course.
Crap,
you know, there are a lot of crap. There's a lot of new crap we're going to see that isn't going to be
retrospectively
screened
in
60 years' time.
Yeah.
We won't see Sweet Country in Dublin Film Fest in 2040 when we're imagining.
Jay, I will buy you a ticket.
Thank you, Darren.
That was a really, really tremendous start to things for me. As you say, I then saw a performance on 35mm, which has long been just. Nick Rogue has long been one of my favourite filmmakers because he appears to be insane.
I have never seen performance.
Performance is bonkers.
And if I hadn't been away, I would have been at that screen.
Yeah.
Because I imagine that would have been the way to see it first.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God.
With an introduction by Paul Schrader as well. Because that was
with an introduction by Paul Schrader,
it?
Who, yeah, Paul Schrader, as the guest of honor getting the Volta Award, selected three films that have been inspirations on him to screen and introduce. I went along to all three. The introductions were not incredible, I have to say.
I quite like the introduction to An Autumn Afternoon.
It was nice, actually.
It's emptiness, hollow, and darkness.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy.
Yeah.
Mic drop.
Yeah.
He did get progressively better. He started with Pickpocket on Friday afternoon, I think. And he literally spoke for about 2 minutes. He came along and said, I saw this in 69, and I was a critic at the time. I saw it with a bunch of filmmakers. I had no interest in making films. But then I saw it, and I thought, I could do something like that. So I did, and it was called Taxi Driver. Hope you enjoy. And that was almost all he said.
I'm okay with that. Weirdly, yeah.
I kind of thought, like, did you like it? And, like, I've seen the film before, and I saw it then.
Yeah.
I can understand why he likes it.
Yeah.
That's a very good film.
Yeah.
But I would have liked a little more context. Now, in fairness, it meant that I got out of there really quick, and I was able to have some lunch before I saw him introduce performance. Performance, he said a little more about. You know,
Schrader's he's a bit cantankerous, though.
Yeah.
And,
he is.
And I think it's and in fairness to Dublin Film Festival, I think it's real cool to get somebody of that stature.
It is, absolutely.
Like,
is.
So, I mean, he can say what he wants, I suppose,
yeah.
isn't it?
Just,
like,
he's
in a good mood on the day, you might get a bit more of him. If not, it's like, fuck all y'all. Like,
his coming along has meant that we got performance.
Yeah,
which
and Autumn Afternoon, which
really
is great.
Crazy.
As well. Like,
yeah, Autumn Afternoon, the Ozu film, which we ate.
Which I've never seen.
It's a wonderful Saturday afternoon film.
It really
was.
It's kind of very sedate.
I can't find every Ozu film is a Saturday afternoon film.
Yeah.
Hospital Tokyo Story.
Yeah, isn't that.
Which could kill you.
Isn't that Kurosawa burn where he's like, all Japanese cinema has the flavor of green rice over tea? Green rice over tea being an Ozu film.
Yeah. Sure, Kurosawa.
Yeah. I love Kurosawa. He gets
I
green.
Do, but I, you know, Ozu gets damn, should get damn or more respect than that.
Oh.
just not to focus all on the old ones. Of the newer films
for
I've
the
seen,
kids, Ronan.
Yeah.
Dawson their... City was the one that I've really loved so far, and I think you both have probably seen more than me at this point. I had to sort of skip the last 2 days of the festival. The other one I really enjoyed was That Summer, which is essentially before the Maisels shot their Grey Garden film with the Beals.
Oh,
they had been cameramen on a similar project, which was ultimately shelved. So there was... there were four reels of film shot for that.
With the
Maisels as camera people, with the Beals.
It
was effectively going to be that kind of project.
A prequel.
Sort of, that's the way it comes across. So the film gives you four reels of footage of them, and it's, in a way, it's more of the same, but I'm very happy to watch
it. I mean,
that.
I'd watch 10
it's
hours of it.
Absolutely wonderful. You know, so many cantankerous moments of them fighting, but being really affectionate, and, you know, seeing the condition that their house was in.
Yeah.
And it just such, and it does often at times, you're watching it and you think this is scripted, you know.
But that's because of how everything has been informed since.
Yes,
I think it's
of
the
course,
part of, isn't
know,
it? Like
the
reality
HBO TV,
everything like has informed how you
exactly,
see something like that.
Exactly.
Of course it's scripted
because
we couldn't have that naturalistic like that. But, you know, you forget the 70s or, you know, early 70s, late 60s or whatever.
Yeah. It's an absolute treat to see. There is a sort of strange framing narrative put around it where they talk to, I forget his name now, but the director of this original project, and he has some really interesting photographs of Andy Warhol, Truman Capote, other people he worked with through the years, and it's very unrelated to the Beale material. I don't think it sits well at all. It's interesting. There's a nice 5-minute intro, but it has nothing to do with the rest of the film. You kind of think,
it's
well,
the baseball sequence, basically.
It is. But on a whole, really enjoyable. Though, now that I say it, that almost counts as an older film again.
Just
the sequel, the latest sequel.
To mention the Maisels, the last few years, like about 7 or 8 years ago, I watched Salesman, which is an astonishing documentary. If you get to see it, Salesman's about kind of the old days of the last vestiges of literally door-to-door Bible salesman. And going around in America, it's like 1968, I think, 1968. And they literally, and then there's lots of kind of conversations, these guys in hotel rooms all smoke and talk about their techniques and stuff. It's kind of like a Clem Gary, Glenn Ross for
Bible salesman.
You know,
so it's amazing.
And it's shot in black and white, and they go to houses and they put the real kind of tongue on the women in the house, because, you know, is your husband home later? And, you know, and they put the pressure on to buy the Bibles. Like, it's big proper Gideon Bibles, is it, maybe? I can't remember the actual...
The Gideons are the ones you put in...
No, it's the other one. It's the Something Bibles or something. It's
the Gutenberg Bibles. The St. James or something?
It's whatever the big fancy edition of it. And
it's the encyclopedia of Bibles, basically.
The film, though. I remember I watched it, I think it was 6-7 years ago, and it floored me. Floored me. But just I'll mention it because I think they're supreme filmmakers. And I watched Gimme Shelter for the first time last year, which is stunning. I mean, stunning film. So and it kind of ties in with performance, I guess, in terms of
Mick Jagger.
But just worth an aside because they are incredible documentary filmmakers. Cool.
A lot of the films that I really liked, we've talked about already, myself and Jay have found ourselves agreeing a disconcerting amount of time.
It's terrifying, actually.
It is horrible. Sometimes I feel a shiver down the back of my spine and I feel it's like we've formed
very unusual.
It won't last.
But
yeah, in particular, I'd like to second Jay's recommendations, particularly of You Were Never Really Here, which is fantastic, going on wide release. And also Dawson City Frozen Time. I've seen a whole bunch of other stuff very quickly. Filmworker is great, which is the one about the...
Stanley Kubrick's assistant.
And Leon Vitali, yes. Mm-hmm. It's a little unfocused in places. It suffers from like a lack of structure in the middle. It has a really good beginning, a really good end, and it's kind of interesting in terms of looking at how we look at directors now in terms of capturing like the good and the bad of working for somebody's artistic vision, when that artistic vision includes setting up a camera to watch their sick cat as much as it involves coaching or the army to act.
Are we going to run out of Kubrick's people to find to make documentaries on?
Well, that's
maybe
his
driver
you
as
have,
well.
Have,
like, I mean, at some point, nobody left.
Okay. Well, to be fair, Vitali is his facto.
No.
I mean, let's not.
But wasn't there one done about the other guy, his assistant guy, Jan Harlan? Wasn't there one done?
Was there?
I thought it was.
Maybe did we get the fake Stanley Kubrick before he passed away? That's the question I want to know. You know, the guy who used to go to parties in England posing as Stanley Kubrick despite looking nothing like him, but apparently managed. It's a fantastic story.
That's so weird.
Well, because Kubrick was notoriously sort of like personal or whatever.
Yeah.
This guy would just go around and claim to be Stanley Kubrick and use it to get.
Hey, I'm Stanley Kubrick. Yeah.
Hey.
I presume he talks to that.
Yeah. I really like that. I also saw Revenge, which was the closest thing the festival has to a Midnight Madness strand. It was the one that did the Midnight Madness
one
at
day.
TIFF. It is. Well, I mean, one of my favorite festival memories is going to see Dawn of the Dead with the original soundtrack by Goblin. It was amazing. It's one of my favorite cinema going experiences. It's just fantastic. It was on until 2 a.m. Revenge is basically if Nicholas Winding Refn directed a Blumhouse movie that wasn't Get Out. So it's this sort of like Hills of Eyes revenge thriller.
You lost me at Nicholas Winding Refn, quite frankly.
Okay.
But anyway, go on.
But it's absolutely beautiful. It's neon drenched. The cinematography is fantastic. The music is pulsing. It's got this sort of wonderful eye, and it's got this sort of female gaze as well in terms of how it shoots its male characters, which is fascinating. The final girl ends up being this six pack sort of French guy. Which is remarkable. There's a shower scene based on Psycho that inverts the dynamics in an interesting way. I really liked it. And yes, it's very visceral. You feel every ounce of blood. This is the one where famously they boast they had paramedics on site for the Toronto premiere.
Advertising. They've been doing that for
years. Well,
Signs of Lambs had a big lot of that kind of stuff.
And then just more broadly, I saw The Breadwinner. Myself and Jay again had another overlap in watching The Breadwinner.
Breadwinner separated by thousands
of miles. Jay was watching it on Netflix at the same time that I was watching it at a premiere where tickets cost €16. It's a beautiful film. It's a very, very good film.
And it should win the Best Animated Oscar because it's better than Coco.
It is better than Coco.
But anyway.
No discrimination here. And a couple of Irish films. I saw Black 47 and The Cured. Black 47 is much better than The Cured. Black 47 is great. It's very much it's the Irish Famine Western starring Hugo Weaving.
The Irish Famine Western you never knew you needed.
Yeah, but it scratches that itch incredibly well. It's one of those, it's very much of a style with the post-colonial Westerns you've been seeing, like The Revenant, The Hateful Eight, even Sweet Country, which is worse example.
That's what I'm saying, aren't you?
Well, much better than Sweet Country.
Indeed.
But it's very clever, it's very well observed. And one of the things about the festival this year, myself and Jay were talking about this yesterday, was in terms of watching Irish film reach a point where... Like, the past couple of years have been phenomenal. We've done a remarkable job demonstrating that, like, Irish cinema can do everything that, international cinema can do in terms of, like, you want to talk variety, Sing Street, Room, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But now doing stuff like engaging with sort of genre and pulpy trends and stuff, and like positioning films that are part of what I would see as like broader cultural trends.
Yeah.
Like, for example, Black 47 is that revisionist post-colonial Western in the style of The Revenant. You know, it's a horror film as much as it's a Western. Yeah. The Cured, which is the zombie film, which is not great, but it's got enough good ideas to get it through. It's very much like the same like post-apocalyptic, but we're living in the post-apocalypse sort of film that you saw with, say, Hell or High Water or Logan, which are very strange comparisons to make for an Irish zombie film.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting.
But I was saying to you about kind of the idea that for Irish filmmakers, it's probably an unprecedented time to get their issue or drama movie into the back door of our genre, like, and finally have a kind of a
framework,
decade maybe of that kind of thing, which would be interesting if it happens. We'll see. It should, I mean it's there for the taking. We'll see.
And there have been films like that in the past couple of years. You look at something like Citadel, which is a horror film that sort of looks
like urban alienation and stuff like that. I quite like Citadel, actually.
Citadel I really like,
kind of had that thing near the end where it explains everything that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got its problems.
But
it's
very
kind of sticks very closely to genre conflict. Yeah. But it's doing something interesting like that. I think we could be in line to see a lot more.
Perfect. All right, then. I guess that's our sort of festival portion out of the way. This is the last podcast before the Oscars this
Say
Sunday.
What?
I know. Who would have thought? So, guys, any last-minute predictions or opinions about the race and the films that are in it?
I am going to go out on a limb and say that the first film they name as Best Picture will actually be the winner.
Crazy. Crazy odds.
Yeah, they're going to make sure that happens.
One, imagines that phones have been banned from backstage. no taking pictures with Emma Stone this year.
If I was a betting man, which I am...
So, as a betting man...
I'm going to say Del Toro, director and picture.
Interesting. I would have Del Toro for director. I'm not sure about picture.
I can see another split. I can see three billboards taking picture, much to my annoyance.
I can't see. I'd be surprised. Although apparently all the interviews, you know, the anonymous Academy voter interviews that they always do.
Which you make up a lot of them, I suspect. But anyway,
fake news.
I haven't been keeping up with these. Whatever.
One of the more interesting ones is Vulture did one yesterday with the new generation of fans.
Okay.
And it's fascinating. The kids, basically, the guys who were drafted you know, the Sid Gaines sort of like brought in the membership.
Are going
Cheryl
to make
Blue an Isaacs.
Incredible
well, they're
difference
gonna,
that have already.
Oh, yeah, they have. And like they're the reason that Get Out is there, to pick an example.
Yeah.
But they're not really plussed by all the hassle and buzz around Three Billboards. It's quite surprising to see the amount of venom that it generates online. And they're just sort of
like their taste, they have taste.
They like it.
Oh, they like it?
They like it.
Okay, so they're nonplussed.
They're nonplussed by the sort of, you know, the broader
discussion.
I found that fascinating because, I mean, I think over the past couple of months, the discussion has largely been how awful it's been. As it should be,
To be honest with you, I'm not saying I think Shape Water will win because I don't like Three Billboards, even though I don't like Three Billboards. Yeah. I'm saying I think Shape Water will win because it harkens back a certain...
Well, it does, but it has the Red Shoes reference in there for no reason.
It has lots of... it has a reference to Alf, for Christ's
sake.
It has lots of Alf. And has the various references.
Shirley Temple and stuff like that.
It makes a real thing about old films on TV. It has these kind of people dancing in that kind of lovely old-fashioned Hollywood colour.
It's black and white sequence, for example. Black and white sequence.
I mean, it's...
You see it getting... The artist kind of.
But
I'm not a big Del Toro fan.
On the other hand, it also has
interspecies
fish sex.
Yeah, no, it does.
Grinding Nemo.
Yeah. I'm fine. I don't think anybody's going to be particularly offended by it.
Okay.
No, not at all. Okay. I think how they introduced the character of the fish is essentially more human than
Michael Shannon's sex scene, which happens earlier in the film, to pick an example.
Ooh.
And Ronan is suddenly on board.
I'd more say about Shape Water, but
we'll get to that.
But I think it'll win Best Picture. I think
it's
daring enough for the people that kind of think that kind of thing is a bit weird, and it's classical enough
for the traditional,
so I think it'll walk it.
It also has, I've been hearing a lot of buzz about Lady Bird, because then the argument is that you're going to end up with split preferences, so you're going to need a lot of second and third preferences to clean up. And the argument is that films like, say, Get Out, possibly, but Lady Bird in particular, may shade it on those terms.
Yeah, I have to say, of the nominees, I guess, Phantom Thread, Call Me By Your Name, are my personal favourites, but I would almost like to see Lady Bird win most of all. So I think there's more to be gained for the industry by it winning. It would be a more appropriate sort of symbolic victory. And I also think it's probably my third favorite of the bunch. I think it's very,
actually my favorite.
Very good film.
Is it? Yeah. After nine. Yeah.
I really, really like it. And I think it would absolutely be deserving.
I've no real truck with Lady Bird and Get Out winning for the reasons that Robin has outlined in terms of, like, they're important. And I mean that, like, I don't mean politically correct. I mean they're good films in and of themselves. What I mean is, I think for an industry that, I think they're worthy winners in an industry that.
Well, I mean, we had this discussion before. The Oscars is nothing but an indication of films that the Academy likes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And
we tend to need too much on them.
How Green Is My Valley is the great example of that.
This is a membership of several thousand people. They're not sitting down in a room and saying it would be politically, it would be politically expedient for us to give the award to this movie.
Yeah, Tony Curtis and Ernest Borgnine refusing to watch Brokeback Mountain, for example, just on principle.
I hadn't heard that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Really should have won anyway. But anyway, look. The thing about what I find interesting, though, and this is what really infuriates me about this whole thing every year, and it's not obviously just the Oscars, it's the BAFTAs, it's newspaper articles, they all seem to cling to the same three or four films. And how is that possible?
Hold on.
Every year, like, how is that possible?
Oh, you mean like the top 10 in general?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean like award season?
Yeah.
Well, the issue is publicity and hype.
But people hit the Academy as in, like, the Academy are...
Well, the Academy are the biggest.
Evil. No, I know. But you get BAFTA and you get, like, newspaper articles. They're all the same bloody four films.
It's a combination of, you get the early nominations and awards. They get the headline space because they've won the awards. So the people who are nominating things for stuff months down the line, and it happens with critics do it all the time. You'll see this on Twitter throughout November and December. Critics will say, oh, here's the list of films that I have to catch up on before year's end. They're pulling that from what other people are saying.
So you get this sort of self-perpetuating cycle of
contenders
and getting knocked out
and stuff on the peripheries. It's consensus.
But I'm not by any means defending. You do also end up with the situation where the people who do go, like, for the fences, you swing for the fences, get sort of, like, seen as being, you know, wrong or out.
Well, okay, if that's somebody saying Justice League, I'd say that's fair enough. But I think there's
Justice League is a masterpiece.
I think there's probably about 30 or 40 films every year that
absolutely
a kind of solid kind of. I wouldn't say not necessarily.
Good Time should be in there.
Good Time.
Why is nobody giving awards to Good Time?
I have some answers to that, but we won't go into it right now.
Your answer or wrong answer, Darren.
But no, I would agree. Like, my end of year list begins with at least 40 films, and it gets whittled down, and eventually you end up with something like Cloud Atlas.
I usually end up with 20 that I'm very happy with.
Yeah,
and like that are solid. Like at worst, very solid. At best, pretty goddamn great.
My issue, though, with the Academy, the award season, and it's a particularly modern thing, is the tendency to reward films in the release cycle. And we talked about this briefly earlier, where, like, you can't go and see... Lady Bird was released last weekend here, 10 days before the Oscars. But even if you go to the States, like, Call Me By Your Name was still rolling out in late February, after it had already received the nominations and awards. And, like, you look at these organizations, like, the Oscars for the Academy is basically funding for their slate of, like, film development, for film restoration, education masterclasses, right? So their goal should be to have as many people watch the ceremony as possible. Mm-hmm. How do you get people who are not like us to engage in a ceremony where they can't see the films in contention until a month before the... until after the nomination's been settled, after the winner's been preemptively crowned?
It is at times a sort of slightly chicken and egg scenario, because you go back to the way that Weinstein reshaped this entire industry.
Yeah.
He brought it to the point where nominations were the marketing for a film, and so you release it wide after it gets nominated, and that's expanded to other territories. That very often you will get films released in Ireland very close to the ceremony, because that's the point where they're able to go by on a Dublin bus and say 9 Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's two problems at once.
And it used to be worse. Like, we never used to necessarily see all the Oscar films before the Oscars either. Like,
I mean, you've got to keep in mind that even going back to, like, the 90s, though, you would have cases like, say, I mean, Silence of the Lambs, the outlier, it's very much the Get Out of that year, but where you would have a slate of, like, summer films that would lead into it. Like, of the nominees, the only ones I think that would really have been in wide release and been accessible to people before nominations closed would have been Dunkirk and Get Out. Like, and I mean, you wonder, how do you convince anybody to watch the ceremony who isn't a big film fan?
Yeah.
Based on that, we were talking about this with Netflix. Like, Mudbound, if Mudbound had got a Best Picture nomination, it would be at the very least, the third most accessible film on the list.
And it should have got a Best Picture.
It should have. It's fantastic.
In Jay's humble opinion.
Yeah. Anyway, well, with that in mind, then, yeah. We will segue neatly into...
Neatly
into the top 10. But we are going to be talking about many of the films that we just talked about. Yes. So let's take a look at what is in the top 10 this week.
Hit me with it, Darren.
Yeah. Darren's just going to leave a pause here for Niall to edit. Fantastic. At number 10, a film that I'm sure all of us have seen, it's Le Bohème, the Met Opera 2018, which earned $41,000 this weekend.
There's such a market for that.
Event cinema is huge these days. And Element are making a fortune.
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah,
it's pretty consistently sold out. It's cracking
the
top 10.
Jesus, who'd have thought it?
Well, I mean, yeah, cinema is changing. At number 9, Early Man, which I'm not sure any of us have actually seen yet.
I missed it completely. And do you know what? It didn't seem to kind of
hit
that point where...
Did they generally
be a bit more aware of like Shaun the Sheep or...
Well, Shaun the Sheep's fantastic, but I only caught that on DVD and Blu-ray. I only caught that on television.
I only caught it as well. Yeah,
there's a lot...
I'm not sure I've seen an Aardman in the cinema ever, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've seen Aware of, glorious. Actually, I love Shaun the Sheep as well. But,
with Ray
Fiennes. I'm sure we'll see Early Man at some point.
At number 8, then, The Shape of Water, which I think myself and Jay have seen. Have you seen, Rob?
I have not seen
it. It's fine.
It's the one Next Picture nominee.
Darren really likes it. Darren's wrong. Darren.
Whoa, I like that preemptor, just get in there. Darren quite likes it. It'd be my fourth pick on the Best Picture.
Fourth? You were going to bat for the fourth, really?
I'm not going to bat. You threw me into the bat.
Sorry. Okay.
You came at me with the bat.
I did the Mirror of the Untouchables. Yeah, yeah. Enthusiasm.
Yeah. It's like a team. Jay is circling the table right now, rather ominously.
It's okay. I liked the first 45 minutes or so. It was kind of seemed to be building up to something really interesting and really profound. It kind of slows down to almost to a halt for about a half an hour to indulge in a romance that it didn't really build a character work for. So I didn't get emotionally invested in it. Michael Shannon, and I've had this discussion privately with Darren, so you laugh, Darren, as well. Michael Shannon and this bad guy thing is one note at this stage. I'm sorry. Oh. Michael Shannon is capable of great work. And like Revolutionary Road, Born of Empire, when he's to put upon Schlob that's quietly raging.
Oh, yeah, the Prohibition.
Like that kind of stuff. I like it. Shannon shouting through films is getting a little wearying.
I love
not going to spring in and defend him here because I haven't seen the film, but the trailers do make it seem as if he's just kicking it.
He does what Shannon does.
I love the idea of Jay's hot take also including Clark Gable be a bit less handsome and conventional. Maybe Woody Allen
it's not the same thing. It's about performance and sticking to that kind of thing.
Shannon has talked about how he goes and auditions for like romantic leading roles and always ends up with the villain and is completely confused by that.
But when he does something else, he is great.
And really?
Like, something like Take Shelter, which obviously is with his villainous
tendencies. Even,
but Take Shelter has more shading to it.
Yeah.
Midnight Special, which is not very good. But yeah.
Near Shotgun Stories.
Yeah. But anyway, so in that mind, then we'll jump to a possibly less contentious film, apparently. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I think myself and Ron are fairly clear on this one.
I am also fairly clear on this.
Darren, you're...
This would be my third pick on the Best Picture ballot.
Why do I think they'd be higher? I don't know. I'm intrigued by this. But it could be the intrigue and all that.
I haven't seen Shape of Water, but I've been very heavily debating whether or not Three Billboards comes at the bottom. Is it
really?
Darkest Hour or Three Billboards?
Let me tell you something, though. Darkest Hour, I don't like Three Billboards, but in Darkest Hour makes Three Billboards look like Raging Bull.
I would agree with that entirely. Myself and Jay have reached another agreement.
And I don't say this lightly, right? we don't.
But yeah, how is
Darkest
that even
Hour
like,
is genuinely, so BBC Two. On a Wednesday afternoon territory. Yeah, it's appalling.
I'm very much of a, like, there are no wrong opinions, Ronan, but this sounds a little bit like a wrong opinion.
I cannot emphasize how much I loathed being in that cinema. I'm not even sure which of the films I'm talking about anymore, the most about.
Yeah.
I think we're all in agreement with that Darkest Hour's term.
At number 6, then, Coco.
Yeah, it's fine. Coco's a weird one, because it has a lot of character work to spade through in the first half. Like, has to put a lot of kind of contextual and characterization. And I was a bit kind of, I don't know about this. And then that, all that pays off the second half. It's like, God damn it, Pixar. So it was, again, it was welling up a little bit in the classical way that Pixar did at the end. It's like, yeah, you won, you feckers. So, yeah.
You broke my heart.
Yeah, a little bit. It's good. It's not. Yeah, no, because Darren's cold now.
Well, Darren, I actually teared up. Every time I've watched The Shape of Water, I tear up at one particular sequence in it.
You like interspecies sex, though, don't you?
I'm all over it.
It's very emotional.
It's not really. Yeah, it's what's a furry but with fins?
Oh,
Albert
Finney,
scaly. Hey! But yeah, no, like, The Shape of Water actually does genuinely move me.
It didn't really. I wish it had, but it didn't.
All right. And then at number five, that will move you in perhaps a different way. 50 Shades Freed, which I want to see.
Darren, oh, you're going to watch them all, aren't you?
I'm going to binge them.
If you watch them, I'll watch them.
Deal.
Does anyone understand what's happening with the title? What does that mean?
I think it's because it's the end, so it's like the bondage relationship that they have.
Yeah, but it doesn't make sense.
But like, yeah, what is 50 Shades? Like, 50 Shades are great, fine. 50 Shades Darker, fine. 50 Shades Freed?
It was, I think, Stacey Gradden suggested that you could have put it in 3D and then have 50 Shades Freed. that would have worked so much better.
Yeah.
I still want to watch it, though.
We may get to it there.
Yeah, myself and Jay will have a discussion.
We occasionally do this. We watched Diana.
Yes, Diana together, which was a phenomenal experience.
Oh, it's one of the best comedies ever made. It's incredible.
Sometimes you perform the surgery, and sometimes
the surgery performs you.
That's not
myself.
That's
and
a line.
That is a line.
You need to watch it. ASAP, bro.
It's not. It has a cardiologist. It has a cardiologist who loves fried chicken. It's fantastic.
I just have a feeling it would be like WE all over again.
It is, except much
better. It's rich.
It's one of the greatest.
It's like the Book of Henry.
It's funny.
Oh wow, Naomi Watts really does need a better agent.
She really needs a new agent.
At number four, not inexplicably, but heartwarmingly, The Greatest Showman is still in here.
It'll be here till the day we die. Yeah.
The Greatest Showman will not stop. It does not feel remorse. It will follow you.
It's just becoming like, it's quietly become a massive cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
It is something like
it opens second to Last Jedi, 8.8 million in its first weekend, and like a
The Last Jedi seems about two or three years ago
by this comparison. Hugh Jackman is still singing and dancing. A new sing-along version.
His ankles must be sore.
A new sing-along version released in cinemas this weekend.
Good lord.
Which it probably explains the little bump that it got, because Jay was pointing out it went up again this week.
The UK went up another 18%.
Alright, at number three, myself and Jay are going to have words about this one. It's I, Tonya.
Yeah, I like I, Tonya.
I like the acknowledgement there.
I, Tonya doesn't exist if the Wolf of Wall Street doesn't exist. It takes its cues hugely from...
A lot of films don't exist if, like, Scorsese doesn't exist.
No, but it's particularly for... It takes
Boogie Night doesn't exist
basically,
if Scorsese doesn't exist.
Can we just stop? I agree, right? Okay. But the Wolf of Wall Street takes the Scorsese narrator into really unreliable territory, right? You know, he changed the colour of the Ferrari, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, it's like it's the white Ferrari, like Don Johnson and Miami Vice, you know, that kind of stuff, right? Which is great, and I really like it. This has three people doing that in this film, right?
And tell me it's not amazing, Jay.
No, it's not. But it's not without merit, right? Robbie is brilliant in the lead role. She's great, and she's on screen pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
And she's fantastic. What's his name? Sebastian Stan is the guy. He's okay. He has a moustache because he must be
extremely nondescript.
Yeah, he's a little bit.
I actually liked him here. I haven't registered him before.
I'm a little.
He was the
queasy.
Guy who was in Logan Lucky as the standee.
And he was in all the Marvels. But
all the Marvels.
He's the guy in the Marvels.
Yes, he is. He's the guy with Mittler arm.
Yeah, that's one. Right.
The Winter Soldier.
All that's fine. The Allison Janney and basically will win an Oscar for saying the word cunt. Basically, over
no,
and over.
She won't.
That's all she's been. She looks like Deirdre Barlow and curses at people. I mean, that's not a. It's not really a performance as such.
That is
sorry, it's not really a performance. Laurie Metcalf is leagues, and I mean leagues better.
We'll disagree on this. Like, we'll agree to disagree on this.
Like, Metcalf, do you remember when Subtlety used to be like treasured and
Gary Oldman is about the best actor.
Exactly. And I'm not saying Janny's gone full Gary Oldman, but she's not.
She has not gone full Gary Oldman. You never
if you
go
see
full
the
Gary
film,
Oldman.
I think you might not.
No, it me. Is. It's a heightened performance because it's a heightened film.
But and I love Janny. I've loved her in pretty much everything. But and initially, it's like, oh, she's great. And then, but the end of the film is exhausted by it.
I know,
because it doesn't change in any way, shape, or form, and it just beats you down.
Moves. The thing moves. It's right, amazing. It's exhilarating.
But you know the funny thing is about it, and this is the thing I quite liked about Itania, and this is why it kind of gets a grudging pass from me, is that eventually about half an hour from the end, it kind of the story has to be wrapped up, I guess, right? So it settles down. And it becomes a much better film. I was like, now I want to see the goddamn drama that it could have been.
But
and
it becomes a much better film in large part because it twists around on the first hour and a half. There's
disagree.
A point where she turns
disagree.
The audience and points out that you have been laughing at.
Yeah, I know, but she gets away with the... You made that point about, because I was a bit queasy on the domestic violence stuff,
yeah.
How he blew it, because there's too many punchlines in it for my liking, and how literally and figuratively punchlines.
Yeah, I didn't want to make that point.
No, I'm fine with it, because they make it. Like, I'm like, you know, I think it's done. And they do make a point of it in terms she turned around and kind of implicates the audience and how...
Yeah,
the
fact that
fine.
You laughed at
but again,
it or
again, Scorsese does at the end of Wolf Wall Street, where he turns
with
the camera
Jordan
to the audience. Like, yeah. And the Belfort thing in it. And that's fine to do it, and... They just about get away with it, but it's a bloody fine line, though.
I think the fact that they just about get away with it and the fact that it's so ambitious makes it brilliant. But
it's not brilliant, but I know what you're saying. It's
brilliant.
It's not brilliant.
It would be third on my best picture ballot were it on the ballot.
You are out of your gourd, man.
It's fantastic. But anyway, let's talk about something where our positions may be slightly reversed with Lady Bird.
Yes.
Which is grand.
Lady Bird is brilliant.
I like it. It's good. But Jay, go.
Lady Bird.
Or Ronan, go,
actually.
I gushed plenty about it last week.
I watched at the weekend. I took a day off, made it on Sunday, and saw Lady Bird Shape Water. Lady Bird, I was expecting to like, largely because Ronan and Philip liked it. And we generally align, and relatively speaking, maybe to varying degrees. So I was expecting to kind of like it, like, and enjoy it. And I did. But what I wasn't expecting was two things I wasn't expecting. One, the subtle screenplay that is joyous and quiet and loud and in just the right moments that it should be. And it's so skillfully used. The words are used. The actors know they're in really, really capable hands, both in direction and script. But what's really, like, the performance are great, and that's not, but what really sold me in the whole film, and this is the thing that I think is brilliant, and I mean it's brilliance, and it'll make it stand out for years to come. It has this, between Gerwig's direction and the editing of the film, it is edited in such a fashion and so quietly that days become weeks, days, and time slips away in the way when you're younger, you'd never think things will end, you never think you'll end school, then it just, all of a sudden the school's over and you're kind of torqued out the gate and it's done. And the editing in that kind of thing, to put yourself in Sir Sean's character's place, to kind of how things just go by almost without your knowing. The editing is an absolute masterclass in how you put a film and really, really layers the film in that kind of sense of belonging, in the sense of loss, in the sense of yearning for things that you don't necessarily understand. And it adds so much to, on an already brilliant script, some absolutely fantastic direction and extraordinary performances. I think it's a brilliant film. Like, a genuinely brilliant film. And, like, it's by... Only Phantom Thread comes close to it in terms of the Best Picture nominees. Everything else is miles beyond.
We were hanging out at the Lighthouse at the weekend, seeing a lot of films and stuff. It was amazing that Lady Bird was sold out pretty much continuously.
Yeah.
I believe, I'm not entirely sure, that it may have sold out every screening it had at the Lighthouse over the weekend, which is a phenomenal performance.
Well, Saoirse is a good sell, like, regardless of anything. Like, she's a brilliant actress.
Yeah.
And everything she kind of does, like, even in films where, like, I wasn't that sold at Brooklyn, but my... God,
her
relationship is incredible and anchors all film.
Yeah.
Whereas the Dal Mio guy and the rookie guy are just by the by, like, you know what I mean? No?
The Dal
Mio. Yeah, oh, God.
What's the matter with you? Oh,
no.
They're a city.
No.
I'm sorry. They did it. I didn't do it. They put the character together. He's the Dal Mio guy.
Jesus, Jay, you're the punchline guy and you're the Dal Mio guy.
This is the character they
Jay
created.
Is telling it how
the
it
cliche
is. The
cliche Italian in Brooklyn is, hey, what's the matter with you? Let's go to the ball game. Bada bing. It's awful.
Right.
I'm sorry. I never trust a rupee guy. That's in a bank.
That's
even
plain.
When he looks like
I said that 3 years
that
ago, and now look where we are. Moving on.
To talk about what Richard did. But Roman, do you want to talk about Lady Bird, actually? Because, I mean, I know you're a big fan of it.
I am indeed. And I think I'm not terribly surprised that it is selling as well as it is. I mean, you get the combination that it's Oscar season, it's Saoirse Ronan. But I think it caters more than people have been talking about, to an audience that is kind of underserved.
Yeah,
in that,
I'd agree with that
you don't get these portraits of women in adolescence
on this scale
half enough.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people have complained that it follows set genre lines, but it does that in such a way that it plays with them. You know, it has the first sex scene, which is fantastic. fantastic.
And that line.
And
nobody's on top of the first time. It's incredible.
I lost it.
Yeah, same here.
It's the kind of thing where people start looking at you and you're like, I'm the person I hate normally.
Yeah, yeah.
Fine. Yeah, that absolutely saved me. And I think actually I predicted, it's by no means a great prediction, that it would play really well with Irish audiences for the sort of casual blasphemy. Reaching
the abortion,
the
eating community waste was glorious.
Absolutely,
isn't it glorious? They're not consecrated, was it?
It's
okay, they're not consecrated.
Yeah.
It's so
such
true
a
to growing up
well.
Under Catholicism where you have this sort of very casual relationship.
Oh, Jesus, that's fantastic.
It's, I think it is absolutely hilarious. As you say, it's a terrific script, and clearly, Gerwig's cast trust her implicitly. And they, my God, do they serve that.
Can I just make a sorry small point on it in terms of that? I don't know if you read the Vanity Fair Art interview with Ronan and Gerwig. They were interviewed, I think, about a month ago. And there's one takeaway from it. Like, it's a really good interview, it's well worth reading, but there's one takeaway from it that I think is incredible. Ronan talked about on set, like, of the trust and kind of peace and quiet and.
Yeah.
Built up on being able to do their work really and being in a really kind of nice space and kind of after Blue Park, and we talked this before now, Blue Park, this whole idea that the Dave Rose approach, everything has to be
and
you have to destroy chefs and you have to be in character all the time and be
rage filled.
Nobody
method plays as a nice guy.
Yeah, except it's
Daniel Day Lewis plays a guy who makes pastries and is generally pleasant.
But it's all horseshit, right?
Yeah.
It's all
served
male and ego.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, like you want to talk about this? This isn't because Roman mentioned this being an underserved audience. Like I was thinking about this today when I was reading about the Jennifer Lawrence thing, where she turned off Phantom Thread after 3 minutes. Because, you know, not her thing. And everybody is outraged about it. And everybody's really angry about this, like, female actor who presumed to turn off the work of this male auteur. And
that's an interesting point, because I think had she stuck with it, she'd find that
she might like it.
There is some incredibly interesting stuff.
I think Jay pointed out that.
I pointed out that in the IndieWire article that this report on, it was like, somebody's like, well, somebody should tell...
Jennifer Lawrence
ASAP that the nuances or whatever in this film are so important and it should be watched at least 2 or 3 times to really get it. I was like, this is why women are kind of like, nah, I don't want to see a film.
I don't really
like
it.
Because of the people around it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the people around these films. Yeah. Like
that fan culture, which is as much there for Paul Thomas Anderson as for Marvel in many ways.
Oh, no, and Nolan and Kubrick. And
yeah, it's the people who roll their eyes when people say Mean Girls is a great film. And
Mean Girls
Mean Girls is fantastic. Or even Clueless, and are like, Fight Club is a real film.
I'd go to bat for Pitch Perfect as well, if we're going down this road. But anyway,
I
think
there is that culture that pops up, and I can guarantee you, if she had turned off Lady Bird, nobody would be that outraged. If she turned off Boss Baby, which is another film that she's voting on, nobody would be outraged.
Yeah.
Because
it's
a cult of the male director.
It's horrifying.
I'm a huge Nolan fan, for example.
Yeah,
I'm terrified.
And you know the thing about it. Yeah, exactly.
The Nolanistas.
Yeah.
I think one really interesting thing about Lady Bird that I absolutely adore, and it's interesting to compare it to Brooklyn. Brooklyn obviously is sort of much more classical mold.
Yeah.
Brooklyn, which of course is written by a man, adapted from a book by a man. Which is a great book. And I think it's a great film. I really love Brooklyn. I've seen it 3 to 4 times now, and I've cried bitter tears every time.
I might watch it again. I liked
rad.
It, but I never loved it. But go on. Mm.
I like it a great deal. But Brooklyn very much defines its female character's journey of sort of self-actualization in terms of a choice between two men and which man she's going to structure her life around. Lady Bird sets that up
and
deliberately circumvents it.
Yeah.
And I think it does it in such a brilliant way that it says, you know what, you find your life in yourself and women can do that.
Yeah.
And it's so great to see that in a sort of a more mainstream context. We've had films like that.
Yeah. But
they
haven't
reached this
through.
Audience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I would love to see it. You know,
there is
home
a great point in it where there's a moment between Saoirse Ronan and Lucas Hedges where the kind of talk got to fall out. I'm not going to give anything away.
Yeah.
But then there's a...
They talk about the mother being... She's loving
and
scary.
Yeah. And
can't
then, they kind of come together over kind of thing. And it's really beautiful. Like, and very effective. And it's affecting because... It's how people are with people they care about, not necessarily how the film screenplay needs you to be to stick to a formula.
Yeah.
And that's really Gerwig.
Sometimes people emote to a CGI DRJ.
I know.
I think that scene in particular, which kind of it hadn't been obviously because spoilers, but it hadn't been talked about. I didn't have any idea that something like that was coming up.
Neither. I didn't know anything about it.
Gestures to a whole other world of people with their own emotions and their own struggles, and the film is very conscious, especially in the mother-daughter relationship, that everybody has these complexities.
And it's very empathetic.
It reconciles those characters so well, I think. You have a tendency sometimes to... some people have looked at the mother character quite harshly and said, oh, why is she so horrible? But I think the film absolutely leaves you thinking.
But there's two things in that. Donald Clark made a really good point in his review that he said that she works double shifts and works in kind of jobs, and that it may be the point that she doesn't have a lot of love to give because she's exhausted, right?
Which is
made a point. I think that's a good point. But I think the secondary point is what it touches at. There's darkness around the frame in the context of familial issues.
She talks about her mother and her mother.
And then her husband who's also struggling a little bit.
Yeah.
So there's struggle within the family.
No.
It doesn't, and you don't have to make... There's no issue scene to sell it because it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Because the spade work's done by the rich characterization that's there. Yeah. It's a brilliant screenplay.
It's honestly tremendous.
I think it's a tremendous one. Like, I think this is a film that will be still watched 20 years from now. Okay. I think it's that good.
I'm less keen on it.
I'm going to see it next week again. Like, I'm actually really, very keen to see it.
Yeah, it's been a couple of weeks since I saw it now, and I do want to see it again.
I've seen it twice or three times. It's good. I like it.
I'm really thrilled to see what Gerwig does next.
Me too. I mean, and
her writing has always been really interesting, but I think directing her own work has brought it.
I didn't like Frances Ha when I saw it. It's Lady Bird, and I quite like Mr. America as well. I know they're not horror films as such,
but they're all
It has the effect. I really, really want to rewatch Frances Ha.
I first watched Frances Ha and I had the same reaction. I wasn't crazy about it. I rewatched it about a year ago, and more profoundly than a lot of times I've had this reaction, I sort of turned to myself and went, "You were so wrong.
This is a great film.
I love it when it happens. Yeah. I like to be
it. Rarely wrong. Happens to me, but
Frances Ha, I did find myself thinking, "Oh my god, I was so wrong."
I love when a film has the effect, and The Love Witch had that with Ann Miller's first film, which I wasn't a big fan of, which the name escapes me. I watched it before I watched The Love Witch, and I was like, "I didn't really do a lot."
You go back and you watch The Love Witch.
The Love Witch so much. I was like, "I really want to go back and watch that again because I may have been just not on the races on that day because I think there's more to her than and so on and so on."
Sure.
Right. For Love and Adams.
Okay. I did not care for Frances Ha. I did not care for Mistress America.
I like Lady Bird.
I don't see myself going back.
Until it turns the end, but I did look at it.
And finally, number one, surprising absolutely nobody, it's Black Panther, which is great. It's tracking higher than the Avengers. You are one of five people in the entire country. I think Ronan made
Avengers.
Yes,
I still haven't seen that.
I have this
relationship, and I know I'm going to sound like an old fart now, but when it comes to superhero movies, a while back I bowed out because I thought, as a genre, it hasn't got to the point where it's interesting enough to get involved. Exactly. It isn't interesting enough to get involved in the way that, you know, every genre goes through this. Westerns went through it once upon a time where they started to do really interesting stuff. And I wonder, and every time somebody turned around and said to me, "Oh, you really should watch this one," because
this isn't the interesting one. This is a very well-made conventional superhero movie. It's still a Marvel Studios film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I would argue your interesting superhero movies amount to The Dark Knight and Logan, maybe at a push.
See, Logan was the last one that I went along with, and I went, "Okay, I'll trust you." I just that was more of it.
Okay, don't see Black Panther.
Yeah,
Coogler's a fantastic director.
You know, it obviously is a massive cultural moment.
The
fact that's tracking higher than the Avengers.
Yeah,
it's
incredible. But this is what happens when you ignore an audience.
It's not just American.
Yeah. Like you talked about Lady Bird serving an underserved audience. This is an even bigger underserved audience.
Between this ghetto girls trip.
The myth of like women and minorities not going to cinema. Yeah. The three biggest films of last year were all female.
Magic Mike XXL from a couple of years ago.
Which I still haven't seen.
Oh, God,
Magic,
go right now.
Magic Mike XXL.
I like the first one. I really like the first one.
I genuinely think
the issue with XXL is it's too large. There's too much of it.
It's too large.
There's
too much to take.
There's
too much to take.
There is no way you could have too much
of that. I bought it in the HMV fire sale. It's still sitting on my shelf. I'll get to it.
You know, Soderbergh has free reign for the first time in a very long time to just be the cinematographer without directing. And
He's a phenomenal cinematographer.
Best time of it.
Yeah.
His work.
I mean, the scene in the convenience store is one of my favorite movie scenes because it's just pure joy on celluloid.
Yeah, absolutely
it's
tremendous.
Astounding. Anyway, sorry.
Channing Tatum's dance reintroduction. Yeah. There are so many.
I think just on a Soderbergh note, I did, like he was his own cinematographer on The Nick, which is the hospital TV show.
Yeah.
Well,
which it's a fine show with two seasons I'm working on if you ever want to watch it, but. His cinematography is out of this world.
Yeah.
Like how he moves a camera is an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Sorry, just that's his.
He's an extraordinary visualist.
Yeah, he is, and I'm looking forward to that Unsane or
the iPhone.
Yes.
I'd watch it because it's
no,
I love side effects. I will honestly admit I'm
the side effects is tremendous.
Side effects is a great '90s pulpy thriller. It's the kind of like
and he went through that period where he did that. He did Contagion. He did all these things where he just went and sorry, Contagion.
Contagion's great fun.
Side Effects has that extraordinary opening shot.
Yeah.
And then it kind of falls apart at the end. Right. But I liked it before that.
Alright, so anyway, so Black Panther, tracing very highly. I recommend it. It's maybe not a groundbreaking film for Ronan. It's not going to radically.
I probably will go see it for the sake of Coogler, for the sake of the cultural moment that's in it. I think I should maybe see
the manager.
We'll see it and we'll talk of things.
Perfect. Opening this week in cinemas, so we'll start with the big one, Red Sparrow, which is the Jennifer
Lawrence. Jesus, a quiet week then, is it?
Well, it is in the aftermath of Black Panther. Black Panther is pretty much
film festival as well.
Yeah, and Black Panther is pretty much straight through from here until Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is Jennifer Lawrence's Red Widow, Black Widow movie, basically.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently, it's not great.
Everyone is doing those dodgy Russian accents, except for Charlotte Rampling, who doesn't seem to even try because
many.
You say that as if like
no, but she's just turned up and said, "No, I'm
Creed,
not doing this."
Like
she's just put her foot
in the Hunt for Red October.
Yeah. I'm a Scottish Russian submarine captain.
Why Lithuanian, thank you very much.
I love it when these older supporting actors just say, "No, I'm not doing this."
Yeah.
But I love it when the thing about the really great thing about The Hunt for Red October is that Sam Neill is trying so hard, and every time he's in a scene with Sean Connery, you wind yourself
did
Sean Connery not ever think of even trying just to make Sam Neill feel better?
I must rewatch it for that reason.
Also opening this week, an Oscar contender and possibly the favorite for Best Foreign Language Film, A Fantastic Woman, I believe.
Which I'm very much looking forward to.
I've read mixed things in this, actually.
There's some interesting things about the way it represents its... not necessarily representation, but I suppose, without wanting to give it... Not that I know what happens, but wanting to suggest what might happen.
Yeah, yeah.
People saying that it does the whole tragic queer narrative.
And a few people have wrote me, I think, from that sphere.
Absolutely.
I think it's an intriguing film, and
I'm
going to
see it.
We also have opening Game Night, which I am all here for. I'm actually really excited about this.
It's been getting really good reviews.
And it's so wonderfully esoterical. It's a comedy based on a mid-tier David Fincher film from 20 years ago that nobody remembers. It's The Game. It's a bunch of suburbanites.
Is it?
It's the suburbanites who get
like
themselves embroiled
in
like an alternate reality game where they're not sure what's real and what's fake.
Well, because I'm old, right? I saw The Game when it came out of the cinema long time ago. In the 1950s when people went to the cinema and everything was on film. But The Game is really, really intriguing.
The Game is a lot of fun.
Well,
it really is.
Like it kind of cuts at the end, but it's an interesting film.
And it's elevated by the form involved. But I just love the idea of there being now a movie that exists primarily in terms of a parody of a mid-tier forgotten David Fincher film.
I don't think it's forgotten. I think you're being a little disservice.
The Game is sort of well-regarded, but you know,
going to Jason Bateman.
No, that's probably fair to some degree. But what I will say is, I have reached the age where the films that kind of went to see in my 20s are now being parodied. And like, I don't want to throw myself off a bridge the roof of a home.
We'll hug
or
you
a building.
But, seeing this on Thursday. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm taking a break from the festival. And finally,
hit me with it.
Winchester.
Helen Mirren.
Yes! Points. Okay, can anybody else name anything else about this film?
I'm open to say kind of.
Yes! Bingo! Roman gets
I was
going to
say Western, but Winchester. Yeah.
Can Jay take the clincher?
No, he cannot.
Okay, cool. It's based on the famous urban legend of the Winchester widow who made...
Famous urban legend, is it?
Oh, I recently saw a documentary about her.
Yeah, who famous... she suffered from mental health issues.
Okay.
She inherited the fortune from the Winchester Rifles.
She made this extraordinarily large house with sort of cavernous additions.
Yes, she just kept building. There was a conspiracy, various theories about why it was. The most obvious being that she had suffered a mental breakdown and, you know...
She had a child that died quite young.
But the horror story angle that inspired this version of the tale is that she felt guilty about the deaths involving the rifles that her family had helped build, and so she decided that the house would never be silent save for the clanging of hammers.
Okay.
So the workers would never lay down their arms. So you have all these corridors that go nowhere, these stairwells that
it's
open
like
into chambers.
Flanders House.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly. Or like The Devil in the White City, which may eventually appear at some point, where you have the murder hotel. Yeah. But yeah, so apparently the movie is terrible.
Yeah, I thought I heard the word that was bad.
Yeah, it stars, what's his name? Jason Clarke, who looked for a while like he was going to do something
better.
He was
a thing, wasn't he? Almost
he wasn't a thing, but
he was almost a thing.
The human lead in a Planet of the Apes movie, which is, you know, James Franco.
I saw a really strange short based on this story, a sort of odd dancey thing called Sarah Winchester Phantom Opera. It was on Movie sometime back. Very, very unusual and sort of played with the horror aspects of the story. Didn't work at all in an avant-garde context, and I can't imagine it working
who's
in a Helen
this?
Mirren horror.
Directing this is Michael Spierig and Peter Spierig.
The Spierigs.
You want to take us on a tour of their filmography, Jay?
I certainly don't.
we don't have time.
No, unfortunately. Next week, maybe.
All right, but anyway, if people want to find you online, where can they find you, Jay? Listeners want a bit more Jay.
Stalking various film people at Jay Coyle on Twitter.
Perfect. Ronan.
Also Twitter at Baron Ronan.
You can find me at Darren_Mooney. I co-host another podcast, The 250. You can find us online as well. Take it easy. We'll be back next week.
Yes,
cheers,
we will.
Bye.
Bye.
I never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.